at the street light on 15th and Sorority Row, the very street that promotes brotherhood, sisterhood, and friendship. A truck full of young men stopped in the middle of the street, hung a noose out the window, and I managed to make out the words, "Here, niggy, niggy, niggy," in the midst of all their laughter.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. It's Black History Month, so on this episode, we're going to explore the lives of some African Americans in the West. Now, according to census data, only 1.5% of Wyoming's population is African American. So a class at the University of Wyoming is documenting the largely untold history of Black people in the West. Carrie Pimblot teaches the Black West class in UW's African American and Diaspora Studies Department. She says Wyoming's apparent racial homogeneity disguises a more complex reality.
Part of it for me is to recover the contributions of African American people and people of African descent to the state of Wyoming, because they've always been here and they've always contributed. Their history has been erased.
Or perhaps never told at all. A recent ranking by the Southern Poverty Law Center's Teaching Tolerance Project puts Wyoming and four other states at the bottom for not adequately addressing the history of race and diversity in public schools. That's largely because the state doesn't require students to learn civil rights history. But for Pimblot, only part of what she calls Black invisibility happens in the classroom.
The erasure of Black people from the state is both at the historical level in terms of how we've studied and learned about our history, but it's also the actual erasure by the exclusion of people from the state through racist policies and practices.
By the 19-teens, Pimblot says Wild West vigilante justice was in decline, except when it came to African Americans. Wyoming had one of the highest numbers of lynchings of African Americans per capita in the country. And discriminatory public policies made Wyoming inhospitable to African Americans. Enslavement was a risk in the territory's early years. Interracial marriage was illegal until the 1950s. Which is not to say the West didn't offer opportunities. Life in the Old West was a delicate balance between hardship and reward, and Pimblot says African Americans were a visible part of Wyoming history at every turn, as soldiers, railroad workers, homesteaders, legislators.
Their experience was a complicated one that had opportunities, but also had obstacles.
Kanan Hurst and two of his classmates are working on a documentary for the Black West class. They are exploring present-day experiences of African Americans at the University of Wyoming, and what they've found has been surprising.
Even overt racism, which people think is so done with, I'm hearing stories from a month ago, a year ago, 2 years ago that are just blatantly racist. And so with this documentary, showing real-life stories of people saying, yeah, this is what I've experienced here in Wyoming, that makes it real. That hits close to home with people.
Hurst's classmate, Natasha Mitchell, is working on the documentary too. She's biracial, and growing up in a white family in Torrington, she was the only Black student in school until her junior year. She didn't sit next to another Black student in class until college. And it was in college Mitchell started to realize some of what she had written off as playground teasing was actually racism.
I think as a kid, I had never framed it that way because it wasn't talked about that way.
Now that she's equipped to recognize discrimination, Mitchell sees racist attitudes every day. She's one of fewer than 100 Black students at UW, and sometimes that attracts attention. One day, a woman approached her in the bookstore.
And said, like, I just have to ask, like, where you're from. And I said, like, I grew up in Torrington. And, oh, I just had to ask because we don't really have very many Africana women or something on this campus. And then it was just like, bye.
Mitchell says as an African American, she's been accused of cheating for taking Black history classes. She says she goes to the Cowboys football games and hears the N-word thrown around.
Just yesterday, a lady told me that if I was unhappy with the campus climate as a racial minority, I should just go to another school.
And she says all of this over time has a corrosive effect on her self-esteem and how comfortable she feels on campus. So in the face of this experience, Mitchell says it's been exciting to discover there is black history in seemingly white Wyoming. That's the point of the Black West class. On Tuesday, Kerry Pimblot students will display their findings to the public through the documentary film, art, and museum-style exhibits.
The goal is to translate to the public here in Wyoming a sense of the centrality of African Americans' contributions, to recover those experiences, and maybe to revise some of the dominant narratives we have about our own sense of space and place in Wyoming.
Pimblot's ultimate aim is to offer materials from the class to public school teachers so the K-12 curriculum can offer a more complete view of Wyoming's history. That story originally ran in 2014, but the Black West class is being held again this semester with a new set of students hoping to continue bringing Black Westerners into the light. I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. Now let's hear the story of a University of Wyoming alumnus who's also a refugee from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard spoke with Bertine Bahige, who's now an elementary math school teacher in Gillette, about how he came to call Wyoming home and how he's using his story to educate others.
I always thought that I had, you know, my life completely, you know, drawn up. I have all these dreams, and I can see them happening until when the war started. And in the blink of an eye, changed everything.
The war was spillover from the civil war in Rwanda that broke out a couple years earlier. Rebel groups started patrolling the east, where Bahige lived, looking for child soldiers.
I remember that day how bullets were flying, and we always hide under the bed, and, you know, you can hear the boots, because all the soldiers wear plastic boots, getting in house from house and, you know, knocking the door down and pulling people out, and I was pulled out there and, you know, thrown in a truck, and my mom was trying to protect me, and they just shoved her on the side and thrown in the truck, and it was taken away. I spent 2.5 years under the captivity, and I was able to escape and made my way all the way to Mozambique, where I was a refugee for 5 years.
Then Bahige was selected through a refugee resettlement program to come to the U.S. He was brought to Maryland, where the NGOs and government agencies that were part of the program found him an apartment and helped him adjust to life in the U.S.
For example, showing you how a shower faucet works and how water, cold water, orientation, you go to classes at the office, how do you look for a job, they help you fill up application. After being in the country about 3-4 weeks, I was able to get a job at a Burger King in Maryland. That was my first job. And I couldn't speak the language, so I had to work in the back, cleaning and, you know, taking trash out. And, you know, a few months later, after attending English classes, they moved me from cleaning to actually reading the information from the screen and, you know, making burgers. And then a few months later to actually going up front and taking orders. That just made me feel like I was winning a lottery all over again. And then from that point, going all the way and working to the drive-thru. Those basics, it's the key that, you know, can help those refugees become successful, because once they are given those tools at the beginning and show them that the sky's the limit, the sky is truly the limit.
After living in Maryland, Bahige was offered a scholarship to study math and education at the University of Wyoming. He moved to Laramie, graduated, and got married.
I never talked about my story, never talked about my experiences. And the reason behind that was not that because I was ashamed about it, but I did not want people to feel sorry for me. I wanted people to look at me as a hardworking member of my community that is willing to do whatever it takes, you know, to be the best teacher that he can be. He can be a professional. That's what I wanted to portray.
But when Bahige became a naturalized U.S. citizen, a reporter was at the ceremony. When he found out Baeja's background, he asked to do a story.
As I was reflecting about it, and I was like, you know, if this can inspire somebody out there, if this can, you know, get somebody to realize that, you know, your worst day might not be the worst day, and, you know, there is always, always a brighter day if you can just stick to it. You know, I agreed to sit down with him, and he wrote a really amazing article.
After the article came out, Baeja began to speak more about bringing a refugee resettlement program like the kind that helped him to Wyoming. He did more interviews and even spoke with the governor. But not everyone was happy about it, and the backlash started to get personal.
You know, our faces were everywhere. There were times where people were saying, oh, we know who you are, we, you know, we're going to do everything to stop you. And I'm sitting and I'm like, stop me for doing what? You know, this is nothing but a discussion. People took it as if there were going to be a tent city in Wyoming. So there was a lot of misconstrued information that was there. I struggled a lot with that. I struggled a lot because I was like, I could have, you know, closed my mouth and teach my math. But I looked at Wyoming as a whole, you know. Wyoming is a place I call home and say, if I can, you know, I can make it a better place. All these painful events that I have to deal with, that my family have to deal with, you know, will be worth it.
Bertine Baij is still looking forward, hoping to engage and inform more Wyomingites about refugees and resettlement.
It's still hard, because every time I share it, you know, it's to a certain degree, you're kind of relieving it, and nobody want to think about the hard time that, you know, they've gone through. But I try my best to tell it, because I don't tell it for me. I don't tell it for, you know, for myself. I tell it for people to understand what is going on and educate people, because education to me is the key. The war in Congo and Rwanda have one common element, and that was lack of education. People were duped to do things that otherwise they couldn't have done if they were able to think for themselves. So if sharing my story can educate people, you know, it can help people understand, I would gladly do that, yeah.
That's Bertine Baij speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard. Okay, when I say snowboarding, you probably think of layered clothing, frosted pine trees, and rides on the lift. Not a sweltering country like Uganda. But Ugandan-born Brolin Mwege is striving to be the first African snowboarder to compete in the Olympics. A new film tells the story of Mwege's life and how snowboarding wasn't just a hobby for him, but a way to build a life in the West. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Huntington spoke with the movie's creators.
The film Far From Home is playing to a packed house of cheering fans at Jackson Center for the Arts. While the film features thumping music and lots of high-flying tricks, it's not your typical snowboarding film. In the fall of 2012, Brolin Mwege and the film's producer Phil Hessler were both sophomores at Westminster College in Salt Lake City. Mwege had also been interning as a lab analyst at Massachusetts General Hospital. And that's where Hessler says the idea got started.
And once the doctors kind of heard about his story, they were really taken by it, and they told him that he should write a book one day.
Mwege asked Hessler for advice.
And I said, well, don't write a book. Let's find a way to make a film about it.
Hessler recruited Galen Knowles, who became the film's director and cinematographer. Knowles was part of a group of college students who started spending late nights in dorm rooms and at the library working on the project. At first, he says, the plan was simply to make a snowboarding film. But then they met with an LA filmmaker.
And he heard the story and said, what are you guys doing making a snowboard film? Like, this is so much bigger than that. Snowboarding is cool, and that's what makes it cool. But the story is beyond anything that you guys realize right now.
Knowles agreed and even dropped out of college to make the film.
By the time I was 2 years old, I was being bit by a bell. By the time I was 5 years old, I was graduated being bit by a cane. By the time I was 11 years old, I was graduated being bit by a cable.
In the film, Mwege talks about abuse he suffered, growing up in a poor, crowded city in Uganda. His mom emigrated to the U.S. to escape the domestic violence, but she couldn't bring Mwejie. He didn't join her until 10 years later, when someone she barely knew donated money for his plane ticket. When he landed in Massachusetts, he saw snow for the first time. As for snowboarding, he says it kept him out of trouble and gave him a way to cope in his new environment.
How I feel when I snowboard is like, you know, I've left my pain and my worries, you know, behind me. When you have a lot of anxiety and anger built into you, you need that escape to keep you grounded.
As the only African in his school, Mwejie had a hard time making friends until he started spending time on the slopes. Snowboarding helped him build lasting friendships with classmates like Hessler.
2 days after he moved, he enrolled in my fifth grade class. You know, those first few years were extremely tough for Brolin. He barely spoke any English. But we ended up becoming friends because Brolin joined a soccer team that I was on. My dad was coaching, and then he ended up joining an after-school program that would take kids skiing and snowboarding.
When the Hessler family moved to Jackson in 2009, they invited Mwejie to join them.
Over the years, Brolin faced a pretty tough home situation and ended up, you know, living with different families in the area, couch surfing. Brolin was spending so much time with us, we just extended the invitation for him to come with us, and that's when Brolin really became a part of my family and a brother to me.
Both he and Hessler joined the Jackson Hole Ski and Snowboard Club's free ride program and competed in regional and national competitions. And that helped set the stage for Mwejie's quest to snowboard for Uganda in the 2018 Olympics. But Hessler says the journey is really just beginning.
Far From Home is done, but Brolin's story is just beginning. And we really want to use this film as a launching point to start this campaign to get Brolin to the Olympics.
Already they're working with coaches who helped set up the New Zealand and Australian Olympic snowboard teams to create an official team so Mwejie could start competing under the Ugandan flag. To see a trailer of the film, go to farfromhomemovie.com. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Huntington in Jackson.
And since that story first ran a year ago, the full movie has come out. You can rent it digitally at their website. Let's wrap up with the experience of a black student at the University of Wyoming. Keenan Montgomery was born in Minnesota. He came to Wyoming to study English and play football. He's also a poet, and his poem, My Black Experience, shows that being an African American in the West isn't always a story of finding your passion and enjoying the outdoors. Sometimes it's a struggle through a climate of racism, even in the equality state.
On one fine September afternoon, the aura of school was settling in and the UW campus was bustling with young, eager minds. A friend of mine and I were walking to my car and we happened to be talking about the unique nature of Laramie. Shaking his head, he told me, "Bro, I feel like such a nigga in this town, B." I smiled because I wasn't sure if I agreed or not. But on that day, at the streetlight on 15th and Sorority Row, the very street that promotes brotherhood, sisterhood, and friendship, a truck full of young men stopped in the middle of the street, hung a noose out the window, and I managed to make out the words, "Here, niggy, niggy, niggy," in the midst of all their laughter. My friend turned to me and said, "See what I mean?" And I did. A day in my black experience. On a windy and dark October night, a small house began to fill with college students, Pabst Blue Ribbons, and cigarettes, and I found myself mingling with a young woman, a fellow classmate who had forfeited her sobriety hours ago. Yet as we stood alone outside the house, we ran through the topics of literature, politics, and society. In a slew of slurred words, she mentioned, "People are so messed up in this town. You're no different from me, but we live different lives, and I'll never know what it's like for you." And even though she barely had the capacity to stand, I could tell her mentality was one that was capable of promoting peace and equality, the goals of my black experience. In a thankful November, I met a woman with white and black qualities woven into her genetic fabric. She was a symbol of peace, of progress, of civility, and her very existence served as a fulfillment of Dr. Martin Luther King's dream. She was afraid of me. She later confessed to me that her initial reaction to my appearance was fear, as if skin color could bring her harm, as if skin color were capable of damage, as if skin color itself were a terrorist looking to obliterate her happiness. The adoption process had stripped this woman of something we were meant to share, but what I saw was an absence of the Black experience. It is this state that is so unaware of its forceful grip on an immoral and outdated ideology that subliminal tones are used so as not to wake the conscious mind, but we need to wake up. How many more Black significant others have to be left alone on the holidays because bringing them home would upset parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, ancestors, communities, and so on? How many times are we going to promote the colorblind society over the colorful society? See me and accept me for what I am. Don't decide to leave my difference unacknowledged. When am I going to stop running into people who begin their sentences with, "not to be racist, but"? When are you going to stop justifying your disposition to a race of people with the admission that one of your friends is one of us? Why does our political dispute have to end in your assumption that my only source of information is WorldStar? Why, when, how, where, what do we have to do to enhance the Black experience? For starters, we must be willing to see ourselves and everyone else.
Keenan Montgomery graduated from the University of Wyoming in 2014. His poem won a first-place commentary award from Public Radio News Directors Incorporated in 2015. And that's it for this edition of The Modern West. Catch our next episode on the third Tuesday of the month. And if you like what you hear, we'd appreciate a positive rating. In the meantime, you can find lots more stories about the Modern West at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Raina Bush produced this podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell, and I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.